Welcome to Absence Management Perspectives, a DMEC podcast. The Disability Management Employer Coalition, or DMEC as we're known by most people, provides focused education, knowledge, and networking opportunities for absence and disability management professionals. DMEC has become a leading voice in the industry and represents more than 18,000 professionals from organizations of all sizes across the United States and Canada. This podcast series will focus on industry perspectives and provide the opportunity to delve more deeply into issues that affect DMEC members and the community as a whole. We're thrilled to have you with us and hope you'll visit us at dmec.org to get a full picture of what we have to offer, from webinars and publications to conferences, certifications, and much more. Let's get started and meet the people behind the processes. Hi, we're glad you're with us. Today, we're talking with the 2023 DMEC Emerging Leader Award winners and learning a little bit more about the reasons they were nominated for this annual award and what drives them to do the work they do, as well as how they define leadership. Our two 2023 Emerging Leader Award winners are Ashley Brock, who is the Lead Compliance Coordinator for the City of Memphis, and Kimia Vageff, PhD, Director of Analytics Consulting for Alight Solutions. Hi, Ashley. So I think the first question that I have for you is, how do you define leadership, and who do you consider to be leaders in your organization, as well as your personal life, who have motivated and inspired you?
Yes. So I define leadership, or a person that is a good leader, is when they're able to provide or create a clear vision of where we're going as an organization or as a team. And then they also have the ability to understand everyone's roles. So that takes you trying to build relationships, understanding your employees' strengths or sometimes their areas that can improve, and being able to have conversations of like, how can we, you know, accomplish this goal together? I have several leaders. I actually call them my mentors now, and they're my former, supervisors who I've transitioned to other roles, and they have as well. And so when I started, I was in the Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. And so my background is in diversity and inclusion, and just seeing how that office handles so many different types of concerns, issues, compliance with the law, employee relations, union negotiations. One of my mentors was the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Officer. And that was the first time I actually viewed juggling, I guess, in real life of different areas and functions, and having to have a team that you invest in and that you know can do the job. And so that was Shandell Ryan. She's also been elevated within the City of Memphis to assist with the mayor now. So I learned from Shandell the importance of building relationships, whether it's someone from management all the way to someone who's like a new hire employee. So I try, and after, you know, viewing that leadership, to also do that as well. So taking the time to, you know, make connections within my office here, and then when I'm out with our other employees throughout the city, having time if they want to, you know, step away, have a personal conversation, or if I give them my email address and say, you can just email me your concern, if they didn't feel comfortable stating it in front of the whole, you know, training that I might be doing. One of my other mentors was a former supervisor, and she was over our wellness team that the leave of absence office is part of. And her name is Lynette Hall Lewis. And what I've learned from her is basically leaning into my own, authority at times, but also knowledge as being a subject matter expert, having a voice. And if I see something that might cause concern, whether it's a policy concern or compliance with the law, or just in general, the well-being of our employees, if there's a concern, I've seen her just bring it to whomever it needs to be elevated to, and sometimes just doing it herself. And so that's also something that I try to do within my role, is identify any kind of concerns and then doing my best to assist our employees with that information. That actually goes back, I guess, to being what they call servant leadership. So just having empathy for people, listening, seeing, oh, well, this could be a problem down the road. So just sort of being a catch-all to how we can improve our projects and different things and tasks that we have to do for the leave of absence office, whether it's, you know, we have an employee base that is very vast. We have different backgrounds, ethnicities, educational levels. So meeting our employees where they are is something that we value here and that we try to do with our employees. Definitely, if they're in the ADA or FMLA process, how can we assist them to get whatever assistance they need?
That's such a good point. I really appreciate your reference to servant leadership and also meeting employees where they are, especially as you noted with the FMLA and ADA, which can be very sensitive times in their lives. And I think you've already given us some examples of how these folks have inspired you. And it does sound very personal from the vantage point of helping you, as I think you said, leaning into your authority and your subject matter expertise. And that doesn't always come easily or intuitively to some of us, does it?
Right. It's something you have to, you know, you have to do some introspection. You have to understand what your strengths are and then also how you can help the team. And sometimes you also have to put in the calculation your organization, their communication style. I know sometimes we get feedback, well, we've always done this and this is how it's going to be. And then you're coming as, you know, a new leader and saying, well, I think this is best. So having the ability to have those conversations that is not so that it won't alienate people, but, you know, get the buy-in so they can move forward. So those are two things that I've learned in leave management, also in the diversity inclusion world, having to, you know, sometimes make people feel uncomfortable, but the goal is to support those employees and to be compliant.
Yeah, that's a great point. One of the things in the nomination form was information about your experience as the chief negotiator during the city's 2022 union negotiations and the role that absence and disability management played in those negotiations. And you've kind of led me into this question really perfectly, because as I understand it, I've never been part of those kinds of negotiations, but I can imagine that it would be at times uncomfortable, and the ability to really understand everyone's perspectives would be essential there. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yes. Negotiation time is a very colorful time here at the city. And so, we meet several times prior to us stepping into negotiations just to understand the roles and responsibilities of everyone. You meet with your counterparts so you can, you know, build rapport, because you're going to be back and forth for several weeks. So I was asked to lead a specific bargaining unit for their negotiations as the chief negotiator. And I was paired with one of the area's management team. And one way that helped is I had already worked with my second chair on many occasions during the ADA process as being a member of the interactive process. So that was helpful that I'd already built that kind of communication and rapport with my second chair. And basically, the interactive process was something that I definitely use in union negotiations, having to hear both sides, having to review documents, having to be impartial with the areas of what's happening during the negotiation process. So it's sort of, in a way, doing the same thing because we were given a task similar to interactive process. We need to help an employee. We were given proposals and policies to review, similar to what we do when reviewing medical for our employees. And then we try to, in the end, come to a compromise. Usually in negotiations, everyone's not going to get everything they want, but there is something that we can have. The end goal is something that both of the parties can, you know, live with and think is fair. And so that's definitely what I've learned as leading the leave management area. I always want to be fair. One thing that I try to implement and live professionally by is my three F's: to be firm, flexible, and fair. And sometimes in the leave management area, we are definitely compliant. So we have to follow the law and then our policies to a certain extent. But that's also how I try to attack the union negotiations. I wanted to, you know, to let everyone have their time to talk, but I also had to provide the information in a way that they understood that this is what we have to offer you at that time. So it was an interesting experience. I had shadowed or assisted in negotiations a few times, but to be the leader of it and to be the face of the administration for negotiations was a different, you know, thing to do. My legal background, I did dispute resolutions. So it was sort of, you know, dusting off some of my, you know, past history so I can implement it in a different way. It was a fun thing to do.
I would think that your experience as a lawyer would be incredibly helpful to you with all of the various laws and compliance needs that you all have in absence and disability management. To an outsider, honestly, it seems a little overwhelming at times.
Yeah, it definitely assists because my mind sort of is I'm policy driven. I'm also very focused on what are the actual instructions? Like I like to still do like many summaries, like to find the issue, how we're going to resolve it, and just giving different examples. So I'm very analytical. And so having that kind of background where in law school they, you know, make you even more analytical, it's just helpful. And definitely since we have new laws that come, you know, we all have to get ready and up to date with it. And it's sort of at times fun, you know, just to see, okay, well, where are we going to go down with this new law and how is it going to impact our employees? What do we need to get ready to support them? Is something that I definitely, we had a conversation. I, you know, wrote down the notes and then I came up with a process flow in, I think it was in a PowerPoint form, it was in a Word form, just different ways so we can all be on one page. So really it's just service retirement. So it can be a long process at times, but we felt that there was a need for all of the areas to understand who owned certain processes and the time frames that they needed to get their processes completed. And so far, it's been very helpful. It also assists us when we partner or update our external, what we call external partners, which would be the employees management, because they also want to know what their employees are doing, how can they assist them. And so it's sort of twofold. It helps us internally, but it also provides support to our external partners.
I can imagine how helpful that would be, especially because it does seem like there can be so many bottlenecks in that handoff. If one piece is delayed, everyone's so busy. I can understand how things would fall through the cracks there, which would be worrisome on several levels.
Yes.
So can you also share details about the flexible work process and the telework policies you created and how they have changed since they were originally implemented?
Oh, yes. So the actual flexible work process and telework policies were initiated due to COVID-19 and the pandemic. So we needed a way to track our Families First Coronavirus Response Act payments. And then we also needed a way to handle if employees wanted to do a work from home request due to school closures. So I worked with the informational service team and we came up with a form site request form where the employee will provide required information if it's related to FFCRA or if it was just a regular telework request. And so that form, after the employee is completed, it will come to my office for review. And then we will also engage the management team just so they could also. We also have worked with the compensation team and our internal HR partners because due to the FFCRA payments, we had to do a debrief and evaluation of the paying. And so the telework policy that was created was to support employees going forward as the pandemic was going down in the 2021 and 2022. And so now we have the opportunity to telework if your area approves it and it goes through the proper channels within the division and the administration.
The next question I have for you is about the mental wellness resource guide that you created for first responders. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, what that work entailed, and what kind of feedback you've received from employees as well as management.
Right. So we take mental health and wellness very seriously here at the city and of Memphis, and especially for our first responders. We want to make sure we provide them with whatever resources that and support they may need. And so similar to the process flow that I created with the different areas, the first responders understood what it meant to go through the OJI workers' comp process to what then how that may impact ADA or FMLA. And then lastly, if they ever do have to do some sort of medical retirement or just a service retirement. So with that, we came up with the idea of just doing a guidebook. I did my portion and I believe everyone else as well agreed to do FAQs. So we wanted to do it in a style that was sort of straight to the point because not only just employees, but people in general have lowest small attention spans and they just want to know the information. So we did it in an FAQ form starting from the initiation of a claim all the way through if they may need to have an extension or if they're released, what do I do when I come back to work? Do I need to have a form or can I just show up? Or if I have to transition them to another area. So we've heard, we have great relationships with our first responders. So they're always happy when we do something, you know, specifically for them or showing that we support them in any way. So they definitely appreciated that we took the time to provide them specifically a guide to help them. And it was also an opportunity that we partnered with our unions. So we definitely, when we having engagements with employees that are of represented parties, we include the unions because they also are assist our employees with issues and concerns. So we want to make sure they also were informed and had the correct information.
And then more specifically to the award, it would be great to hear you talk a little bit about what this award means to you, whether you'd encourage other organizations and supervisors, managers, colleagues to nominate professionals for it in the future, and how this might affect your career growth.
Yes. Well, first of all, I would just like to thank the DMEC once again for honoring me with this award. I was super excited and proud. I enjoyed my experience at the conference. I was, made to feel special, and I really appreciate it. And then also the City of Memphis HR division, especially the Total Rewards area that support and extend me daily grace as I manage our absence of our employee base, and Melody Scott, who's my manager that nominated me. The award, it means to me that my initiatives and the focus that I've had for this area, you have to have passion or for leave of absence. And it may not be for, you know, I just loved the ADA policy or the law, but you might like to interact or engage with our employees. But for me, I know this about myself. I like my work to be helpful. I like to be helping someone that is in need. And as we discussed earlier, the employees that are in the ADA or FMLA process are in a sensitive time of their lives and they want help. And I really appreciate and don't take it lightly that I'm able to help our employees daily. And the award brought it home that I'm actually making a real impact. I know I get, you know, nice words from our employees. Are you really there? You are super responsive. I know Ashley's got it, but you know, having someone outside of the little circle saying you've done a good job, it really, you know, touched my heart. And it also motivated me because it's like, okay, well, you are on the right path. And so it's just inspired me to next time have a leader award, not emerging, but actual a leadership award. And I hope that this award is going to allow me opportunities to lead teams of individuals that are committed to the leave of absence area, to assisting employees that are in need and that are, you know, supportive of inclusive environments, because I have a passion for diversity and inclusion that you may now know. And so having a role in a leave of absence is more than just, you know, looking at medical or having one conversation. It's really
your thoughts on how awards like this one encourage more people to not only acknowledge the important work that you all do, but really celebrate it.
Yes. I definitely have heard that, and I feel it as well at times. Sometimes we are, you know, doing the work behind the scenes. We're just keeping everything moving. And it's really, we're not noticed unless something is abnormal or if there's some type of really serious concern of the interactive process while being compliant with new laws that are, you know, submitted to us for review and implementation. So I definitely have heard that. But with having awards like this, it gives someone or organizations something to strive for, knowing that there is an award that's going to recognize you, incentivize you even more to do your excellent work. It also, I think, will recognize not only the employees ability to do their job, but the organization's ability to support their employees in this area. And also it will attract employees or, you know, future employees to that organization because they see, oh, you are, you know, assisting your employees, you're nominating them for this award and they're winning. Y'all must be doing something, you know, great over there. So it's sort of twofold where this award impacts you as the individual, but it also can impact your organization. And it also has given me the opportunity to reflect on the changes that I have done because it's easy just to go to your next I'm a list person. So it's easy for me to just check off and go to my next thing that I have to attack without, you know, taking that time to reflect and say, oh, well, we did this and now we're here. And so I do appreciate that part of this award.
I like that. I'm a list person too. So what advice would you give to people who are just starting out in the absence and disability management field?
Yes. My advice would be do the work and focus on these items that you can change, whether it might be you might identify a large gap or a simple fix. But if you can do it, I would say focus on it and execute it to the best of your ability. Lead with compassion and be a champion of inclusion, not just someone who comes and, you know, assists with ADA or assists with FMLA. I believe we have a greater responsibility to assist our organizations to think inclusively and to offer opportunities for differently abled people or just our employees that may need time to recuperate from a serious health concern. And because you are dealing with people who are having serious medical concerns, don't forget that you are impacting their lives daily. And not to have, you know, too much pressure, but people are stressed out. They're, you know, trying to understand their medical, their likelihood of returning, how they're being paid. They also have, you know, everyone has their own family concerns that they are maintaining and managing outside of their own health. So just being compassionate and understanding is also something that you will need to increase when you are in the leave of absence area.
Well said. Yeah, there are so many pieces and parts to this maze, really. And I think having people like you there to guide and help support people is incredibly valuable. So congratulations again on your very well-deserved award.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed my first podcast.
So now we're going to switch gears and hear from Kimia Vageff, PhD, Director of Analytics Consulting for Alight Solutions. Hi, Kimia. We're glad you're with us. So I think my first question for you is, how do you define leadership and who are the people you consider to be leaders in your organization as well as your personal life?
Absolutely. So there's a ton of research out there, right, on this construct that defines an effective leader and the do's and don'ts and what toxic leadership is. So of course, it never hurts to be well-read. And also, I remember a long time ago, I heard this quote from John Maxwell, a leadership, you know, writer. And the quote is, a leader is one who knows the way, goes the way, and shows the way. I think that Maxwell did leave out one important, slightly small word, or. So I think that it's a leader who knows the way or goes the way or or shows the way. So I don't think you have to do all of those together necessarily. I was one time chatting with a leader who was also a mentor to me, and he was the CFO at the time, and he was kind of, it kind of had morphed into an informal coaching session. And during that chat, he made me realize, we were just talking, and it, he was like, you don't always have to know, you know, the way. Oh, it's okay if you just lean on the, you know, your coworkers and your teammates. Maybe it's folks that have insights that you haven't tapped into. So I think that's one thing that I kind of like added on to that Maxwell saying. It's not that you have to always know your way and go your way and show your way. You can kind of integrate others' information and other insights into going your way and showing your way. And I think that's really important and kind of helps build that leadership relationship across the board. And another point to that quote would be that there's like no mention of followership, like followers or a level of authority or job title that's associated with it. It's really anyone can lead with that definition, which can be pretty empowering. At least it was for me, because I've had a variety of leaders who've really known the way and, you know, gone the way, and I followed that, you know, kind of mirrored them. And they've really shown me like what that kind of like tour guiding effect looks like and where to follow and where to lead. So I think that that's one area that I think is really important in defining a leader, and a good one at that. I've had a variety of managers. I've had, you know, some good ones, some bad ones, some very bad ones probably. And I've had the opportunity to really pick and choose my favorite characteristics and really reflect on like, how did that make me feel? And also kind of thinking of, you know, the after chats with the team, how did that make like us collectively feel? I, for example, I've had a manager that never checked in, you know, probably had no idea how many people were even on the team at a given time. And I've also had a manager that micromanaged and wanted me to track, you know, every 15 minutes of work right down your task list. Yeah. So I think that there's extremes on both ends. And that there is research that actually shows there is a direct link between the autonomy provided and just better employee well-being and satisfaction on the job. So I think that that's where I noticed like, okay, so I really did like the autonomy, for example, that the manager that didn't check in gave me, because I didn't feel like, you know, watched over excessively. And it also, in that same light, made me feel as though he trusted me. He knew I was able to get the job done and didn't have to consistently check in and make me write my tasks every 15 minutes. So I think that that's different from staying informed on your employees' work and making sure, you know, you're supervising workload and removing obstacles. So, and I think actually looking back, all the leaders in my life that have, you know, been a great, you know, North Star for me have done just this. They have specified the expected performance bar. So they're like, this is what we kind of expect, not just to get the job done, but to get it done successfully, to, you know, perform well. They kind of draw that bar for me. They provide a listening ear. And I think it's not just for me. It's what I've heard also across teams is they provide a listening ear. So they're there when, you know, that kind of like open door policy, especially now as we've transitioned a lot more to work from home. You have this virtual office open door policy that it's great to just have a listening ear. Even if you are in the office, making sure that it's not just like sitting busy, I'm busy, please, you know, set up an appointment kind of thing. Just being able to have those open conversations and having like a continual pulse on that. And once that bar is defined, I think employees can really strive to reach for that bar. And by drawing that bar, by identifying what that good performance looks like for the employee, the leader also has to, prior to that, understand what that role looks like. So that's one thing I think the leaders that have taken the time to really understand, like, how my role impacts big picture, that's been, I think, quintessential, actually, in a lot of things, in moving the ball forward as well as my personal success, because they've been actually able to understand when it come to them with an obstacle or an issue, they understand where those impediments are and how they would essentially impact my success, possibly. So I think that that's one really cool benefit of a good leader, is they're able to remove those obstacles and down the road potentially reduce stress for that employee. Win-win across the board. So I think one thing that is really helpful for a good leader is that they listen, and not just listening to talk. It's they really listen, and they're a good sounding board. I think once you listen, then you understand, and you're able to kind of, even if you go that next level, empathize with them and understand where the employee is coming from and where maybe those challenges lay. And I think that's where that next layer of success is for the leader in the organization as a whole. But also the trust needs to be built so the leader has shown trustworthiness to the employee, and that the employee can kind of lean in and trust that communication is safe and what needs to be done will get done, and that the leader will have their back, so to speak, because, well, like I mentioned before, they've been heard and they've been, you know, identified in this conversation as what those challenges are and why they might not be able to perform. So that's, I think overall, that's pretty much the key guidance of what has been the ideal mix of some good leaders for, in my eyes, is that kind of combination of defining the bar clearly by knowing and listening to what my job role is and integrating that into feedback and helping me remove those obstacles, but also trusting that I'll get the job done. I think that's been pretty critical in success for all the leaders that I've had.
I think that's really helpful to hear all those different nuances and pieces that really fit together. Thank you for sharing some of those different examples. And I have to say, I love that you started out by saying that there's research on this construct of leadership, which really leads me into my next question, that you have been described as a champion of using evidence-based benchmarks for comparing disability leaves and identifying as well as understanding trends. So I'm hoping that you'll talk a little bit about why this work needed to be championed and maybe some of the reluctance that you might have faced or the confusion that you helped dispel there.
Yes, absolutely. My passion is based in empirical evidence and statistically examining data. So I think that doing that through a scientific lens is where I have always come into the picture. Oftentimes, if you don't measure something, you essentially can't prove if you've improved it or not. So there's this reluctance at times to these guidelines or benchmarks. And it can vary vastly across client to client. I have maybe a funny example, but it's kind of like if I have a set goal weight, let's say, and I believe I've been working out hard, I've, you know, been eating right from what I believe. And then I step on the scale and, well, the dial's a little higher than I expected, compared to my set goal weight in my mind. Well, if I'm not willing to use that evidence, that benchmark, to guide more questions and to ultimately, drive what the underlying factors are, that evidence is going to build reluctance towards even stepping on the scale. It's not going to become information that is actionable for me. I'm confused. I don't know where to go. I've already tried everything. I throw my hands up. And that kind of mirrors the reluctance around benchmarking. Oftentimes folks, they draw that line. They select something kind of blindfolded and they track it. And they're like, well, I don't know what to do here. They identify kind of like this discrepancy, let's say, between where they are and this benchmark. But then, for example, if you take the goal weight and the number that you actually step on the scale, when that difference is there, you build this reluctance and then you just kind of get stuck and you don't dig deeper. But what we do with benchmarks is it's able to tell us kind of where this normative information is, where should we be? And we have to select this very strategically also, mind you. So I think that, let's take that example and take it for like a disability duration benchmark. So there's actual evidence-based guidelines out there that can help employers or TPAs use that to benchmark and identify not only those individual cases, not only those individual weights, quote unquote, but also helps with that macro level trend. And so think goal weight versus what you actually stepped on scale. But you can't just stop there. So if that discrepancy isn't favorable, this is where that reluctance comes in. Then you have to probe and test and evaluate and set those best practice solutions. It's always going to be beneficial to understand and set those benchmarks and track where one is at any given time and whether or not they've progressed towards any benchmark, any milestone, essentially. It's a goal that you're working towards. So that's where I feel like it's really helpful to lean towards that empirical evidence.
I love the example that you're giving there with the goal weight and the reluctance to step on the scale. It helps because as you're talking about empirical evidence and the benchmark data, it pulls it into the realm that I think most people can understand and maybe identify some of their own personal and emotional reluctance to stepping on a scale. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how the work you've done or what work you've done really to change how the industry thinks about benchmarking.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I've done consistently that I'm really proud of and actually have encouraged my team to do as well is just inform them of what benchmarking is, why it's useful, and how they should be using it, really the how, because benchmarking really is critical. Understanding the statistical nature of a benchmark is also very important. So what makes up that benchmark bar? Understanding what kind of employers are going into a benchmark metric, what's the benefit plan design of the benchmark metric, what's the size, are we talking about, you know, jumbo, or are we talking about small mom and pop trends? So I think that really explaining to a client and just getting an employer to understand what the weight of a benchmark is. I often compare it in my conversations with clients. I say, this is like a limbo bar. If you set it too high, you aren't really going to have an entertaining, challenging, fun game. You're just going to be walking right underneath it. And there's no identification of what could or could not be better. Now, if you set it too low, then it's going to be an extremely difficult game, and there's going to be some risky stretching going on to even see if you could get underneath that limbo bar. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And a part of that is really just like benchmarking. So it's being smart about that benchmark selection, tying it to your your employer objectives. Essentially, you're saying, how are you positioning yourself in the industry? And how am I comparing you when it comes to this set benchmark? So not just kind of, I mentioned before, blindfold, putting blindfolds on and just selecting a benchmark. I think it's really important to talk about this versus that, and how are we going to compare ourselves? Having that conversation, I think, is truly step one, because they once you set a benchmark, it's really important to kind of be consistent with it, to be able to track and see how not only you've performed, but how has that benchmark, how is that normal outside, or like the outside metric performed, that external comparison, have they gone up or have they gone down? Because, for example, let's say if you've gone up on a trend and the benchmark has gone down over time, but still you're kind of close in numbers, that will show you the comparison and just the trends versus the industry or whatever benchmark you're selecting on compared to what the actual experience is. So really the question and the importance of it is, do they encourage in the root of the workplace culture for the employees, for example, to take the maximum time off? Or is there something else that, for example, maybe they're offering all these plans, but really the workplace culture, there's this shunning of if you actually use it. So there's a lot of these unspoken norms that actually feed into how organizations perform, but ultimately that not only feeds into that organizational performance and how many leaves folks are taking and how long they're going, things like that, but also which benchmark should be selected to make that comparison. The reality is not every benchmark is going to be a good comparison for similar employees, let's say, of a certain size. Maybe their benefit plan design makeup is completely different, even though they're a similar industry size. Benchmarking should be selected strategically, but also consistently, like I mentioned, because if folks are selecting a different benchmark each year, because of course some clients, they change, that your employer might have a merger and acquisition, the whole makeup of the workforce might truly change, therefore the benchmark might truly change. Some clients, for example, might just feel like they have changed, but in reality they haven't, and they just might choose different benchmarks each year. So choosing a benchmark, being consistent with it, being strategic with it is really the first step, I believe, of benchmarking in general in the industry.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I'd love to hear about some of the changes that have been made to internal reporting as a result of your work to encourage more benchmarking.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one thing that is really important that we do is working with the client to select that benchmark line, as I mentioned, and making sure that it connects with their strategic approach. It connects with the way that they truly compare themselves in the industry. Some folks are really one of a kind, and identifying how that client, how that employer is truly one of a kind, what makes them one of a kind. And let's say they have many more plan offerings than another client. We wouldn't necessarily want to compare, an apples versus oranges situation when we're talking about utilization. And maybe one client has, they are approving a lot more than another client, requiring different type of documentation. So there's trends that push and pull based on policies and stuff like that. So one thing we've done is basically identify what it is that these clients perceive strategically, as well as how they fit into the industry. So we'll often ask the client, is this the right benchmark for you? And so we would recommend a different benchmark, or maybe we would recommend setting, for example, seeing how they compare in those specific diagnostic evidence-based guidelines and comparing those set benchmarks, those evidence-based guidelines, and seeing how the clients compare in specific diagnoses and major diagnostic categories and highlighting, you know, days saved, or if we're seeing consistent trends, identifying what can be done in regards to, again, making sure. One thing I want to highlight is it's not about moving the benchmark when one doesn't perform effectively to it, right? You don't reset the limbo bar every time you fall, but you have to understand which setting to set the limbo bar at consistently, essentially. So I think that it's okay if you don't, you know, you can't go under the limbo bar 1 year, but making sure that you have selected the correct, you know, benchmark to compare yourself at is critical. And again, I think that feeds into the selection of those benchmarks and why we would customize them, essentially.
Okay, so just to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying, I think what I heard you say is that by using the different customized reports as you're describing them, you can work with an employer to understand if the data or if the information that results from the reporting is feeding into how they want to assess their own goals and maybe what they need to tweak. Is that right, or am I off there?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. So we might identify that, like you were saying, that tweak might be identified eventually by, maybe it's not necessarily a benchmark tweak, it's a program tweak, or maybe it is a benchmark tweak and we have to reevaluate because, well, let's say you have a call center and the call center has a specific diagnostic that keeps showing up. So like we have an extremely high anxiety and depression in a call center workplace. Is this organization in line with the benchmarks selected? Have we selected the right industry, first of all? And are those other industries that we're comparing against, are they similar to this? And are their experiences also similar in this, for example, diagnostic specific category? So then we start diving into, is it me or is it you, kind of, you know? And is it the benchmark that's right or wrong, or is it the program and something going on underneath that's right or wrong? And most of the time, it's not the scale, right? It's an internal thing that needs to be discovered and really questioned. Kind of going back to the previous point, really taking that next step after you see, you know, what's on the scale. What do we do here? Do we need to compare you to a larger organization?
It sounds like some of the work that you've done has enabled the company, the organization, to, and I'm using air quotes here because this was in your nomination form for the award, that the work has enabled the organization to provide a clearer picture of influences on claims that have helped employers support an employee's return to work. So can you talk a little bit about that? I'm hoping especially for an explanation like you've given with the limbo and the weight scale for folks who might not fully understand the nuances of benchmarking, but really to get to that second step as you're talking about that why and what do you do to maybe bring to address programmatic issues or different things that might be feeding the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing I do to really, I guess, like you said, air quotes, but challenge the status quo possibly and go get to the root of the question, essentially, is ask why 5 times. Why are we, you know, why do you need that? Why? And essentially we get to the root of what they're trying to compare, and that what is the end goal? What is the decision that's going to be made here? And kind of working backwards from there to select the benchmark and then identify how the employer is performing against the benchmark in any given category. And I think that one thing that's been critical has been maintaining a clear picture of what employers would have potentially experienced if COVID didn't shake up what was more of a normal data set. and by that, I mean the experience that came across essentially has been captured in the data across the years of the pandemic. And I think that one thing that's been really important here has been maintaining, because during that time, folks wanted to say, okay, well, how do we benchmark now? So maybe there is truly a new norm that's created in an organization. There's a number of different things that occurred. And I think one benefit was having the book of business that we have and being able to reflect on trends and data and identifying what was and what could be benchmarked as impacts pre-COVID and post-COVID, and also what is including COVID. There's almost this new norm that we have to create with benchmarking because it's almost like such a different trajectory from what we were normally experiencing. We need to know where were we? So you have to have a benchmark for that. Where are we now? So I have a benchmark for that. And where do we expect to be going and have a benchmark for that?
I see that. And it sounds like you were instrumental in leading the effort to separate COVID claims when evaluating end of year data with clients. And it sounds like that was a unique approach. So you've explained what prompted that. I'm curious what the initial reaction was and what you guys learned from isolating the data.
Yeah, absolutely. It was extremely beneficial, I'll say, particularly because of the nature of COVID and the nature of the type of disability was and its impact. And I think one thing I'm sure we've all heard is that quote, unprecedented time. And the challenge was, although everyone, even our clients, knew it was an unprecedented time, they still needed a clear picture on the claims. But tell us, like, can you kind of separate this out and filter out, like put in a lens that what it would have looked like? Because they really needed to know what that future planning state is for them. And I think a part of it was us trying to figure it out ourselves. And what we ended up doing is taking the entire experience, right, with and without COVID. And we're like, okay, this is truly what it is. This is the now. But when we also, like I said, we want to also see what was benchmarked before. What did it look like? So if we took the now and we filter out the exact ICD-10 codes for COVID based on what the CDC has identified and a number of other organizations have identified as key comparative points, we took that and we said, okay, so excluding those, this is what maybe the past benchmark would have looked like, or current benchmark does look like without the experience of, mind you, explicitly specific ICD-10 for COVID. Now, I always mention here, there is no true ability, unless we lived in a vacuum, to remove the impacts, the trickle down effect, the the ripple effect, I should actually say, of what COVID did to, you know, psychologically, emotionally, financially, at work, just a number of areas were impacted. So by removing just a specific ICD-10 code, you are hitting just at a very specific impact point. However, not addressing the ripple effects. Now, how do we address those ripple effects? We identify what those norms were for non-COVID specific related categories prior to the impact of the pandemic. So we can say, and one statistical saying is, you predict future performance based on past performance. Now, the challenge is when you have a major impact event like COVID that changes what past performance looks like, then you have to be selective of that time frame and say, we want to look at, you know, prior to the event, or do we want to include the event? And that's where you start being selective about those benchmarks and asking the questions for those comparison points. So I think that the removal of, or exclusion of, I should say, certain categories for benchmarking purposes, of course, the reality is that that's included. But by excluding that, and as I mentioned, the nature of COVID is critical to do that, because COVID claims were so short compared to, let's say, one of the previous top diagnostics, musculoskeletal. We have typically very long diagnostic claims there. And so when we take something like a short COVID claim and you present it to an employer as an average, well, that's going to look like we're managing claims really well because we've brought down your duration by, you know, almost 2 weeks, let's say, because the majority of your claims are COVID claims. So to get at the reality of the story and to show them what the picture looks like with and without COVID, and what the industry looks like with and without COVID, and getting kind of that bigger, slightly more clearer picture of the vacuum. Sometimes it means kind of divvying it up and slicing it and dicing it differently for the employer to see, and benchmarking that accordingly.
One of the things that I'm hoping you'll talk a little bit about is the advice you'd give to people who are just starting out in this world of absence and disability management.
Definitely. I think that this is exactly where an individual who is curious and passionate about health and wellness of either the public health or workplace health, to get involved with learning what these numbers mean in the sense of an individual's livelihood. And I think that that's been one critical piece, is my ability to connect statistics with, and I'm in such a great intersection in the world of absence, because truly the numbers that I report on and the metrics that I compare to are people's lives. And I think that getting an understanding of that, and not just at the surface level, but going kind of deeper and saying, what are the big psychological and psychosocial, I should say, theories and underlying drivers of what we see in the absence and disability world. So I think that there's a number of theories out there, at least from my experience in academia for a while. There's a lot of theories and, what scientists and researchers write, and there's this gap in application of it. There is stuff to read, stuff to learn, stuff to watch. And I think that getting involved and understanding how those numbers, like I said, feed down to, okay, what does truly shortening this duration mean? That means that 100 people return to work, you know, 5 days sooner. That means they got paid 5 days sooner. That means that they were able to settle into their job with their coworkers 5 days sooner. They were able to have some more normalcy back in their life 5 days sooner. I think that that's where the impact and the motivation comes in to kind of make that change, make that impact, not only in the numbers, but on a whole organizational level. It's truly kind of like getting that understanding. It's leveraging what's out there, being willing to learn and read and get involved with that material and pulling it into this applied field and using those learnings. And I think that kind of those learnings are essentially critical for improving the absence and disability management industry in general, is diving into, improvement of self as well as the industry, but having that connection to the big picture while you're doing it and knowing why you're learning it is to not just, you know, get the high marks on your performance appraisal, but to ultimately get people back to work sooner.
It sounds like the work you've done within this realm of benchmarking has led to changes in some employer approaches and messaging for employees, and that ideally would help people return to work a little sooner. Will you share some more information about that?
Absolutely. So there's opportunities across the board for employers to get their employees back to work sooner. Now, using the benchmarks, like I mentioned, is critical, comparing oneself against external benchmarks. But also, one thing that I highlight a lot for clients is it's also internal benchmarking and comparing themselves against their own progress over time. And even at times, we've also created specific customized benchmarks. So for example, if we see that there are certain accommodations that are created to help return to work sooner, now there's certain accommodations that might not necessarily for example, there are no lost time. But then there are some where it truly does help return the employee back to work sooner. Those specific types of benchmarks aren't your traditional days saved calculation, but those benchmarks I think are really important for helping, like I said, customized approaches, maybe strategically selecting what that employer is looking for. And I think it's okay to, of course, with some statistical background, to create one's own benchmark in an organization, as long as it has statistically sound reasoning and, you know, best practice theory behind it. There are opportunities to identify a new line that hasn't been drawn externally, so to speak, by evidence-based guidelines. However, they are out there. And so oftentimes there's not necessarily a need to recreate the wheel. So I would definitely say look for what is available and how that might fit. But also using things like our evidence-based guidelines to encourage internal approaches. So for example, taking a specific category that is underperforming and going back and seeing what those failures for returning to work are based on, because it's out there, the evidence-based guidelines for a specific diagnostic. Then we start to dive into, again, with a specific approach, a strategic approach, are these factors of failure showing up in this area? So are these specific employees, you know, coming across these failure points, these pain points, maybe because of how a job role is set up? Maybe it's the work environment. So there's a number of different factors that might lead to failures or delays in returning to work. And so again, by either using these evidence-based guidelines, or if you really have to, creating an internal benchmark, you can really say, I've done, you know, X, Y, Z to make an attempt to return these employees back to work, and kind of selecting it. Like, maybe it's not going to take care of, you know, 100% of your challenges, but I think that being selective, saying, okay, we're going to tackle this, we're going to measure it, and then let's come back to it next year and see how did we end up working out. And sometimes there's a data maturity thing. So you need to allow the data and the policy changes to take place and play out. So there's also the timing of when to compare those benchmarks and making sure that, you know, you're doing an apples to apples approach there.
I can't thank you enough for your time, and just wanted to again say congratulations to you. Such a well-deserved award.
Thank you so much, Heather.